Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard all over the state thanks to Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, Senator Mike Lee says plans for 3D printed guns should not be kept from the public because they are protected by the First Amendment. The Inland Port Authority Board has its first meeting, where one member asks for fewer comments about environmental concerns. And Utah's request for a Medicaid waiver likely won't be addressed until after voters weigh in on adopting full Medicaid expansion. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Good morning, Matt, and welcome.
Good morning.
Tribune reporter Ben Wood, and welcome, Ben. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert. Welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by posting them at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. Ben Wood, the state of Utah is waiting for the federal government to provide an answer on whether or not the state will be granted a waiver to expand Medicaid in the state, the way that the state wants to expand it. But you reported this week that Utah officials are probably going to have to just keep on waiting for that answer. Can you explain why that's the case?
Yeah, there was a report out from the New York Times that said that the Trump administration, well, Donald Trump himself really, shut down considerations of state Medicaid expansion waivers. So there had been this question about whether Utah's waiver would be approved because it's a partial expansion. It doesn't fully fit itself into the mold that Obamacare envisions. But of course, Obama's no longer president, so there was some back and forth on whether or not it would get approved. Now they're saying it'll be after the midterm election, and the challenge there is that during the midterm election, we'll be voting on a full expansion. So where there might have been some hope that we'd have some clarity before we went to the polls, now we'll be voting without knowing exactly what's going to happen with the state's plan.
Okay. So as you said, there's the state plans and then this broader plan from the ballot initiative that we're going to vote on. How do they differ? What's the difference between those two plans?
Right. So the state's plan would cover individuals and families earning up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Full expansion is 132%. Essentially, what that means is the state wants to cover fewer people and impose work requirements, but save some money by doing that, whereas the full expansion initiative would have a tax increase and a lot more federal funding to cover a larger group of people.
Okay, so a much smaller percentage if we get the waiver under the state's plan, then...
Yeah, it's about half, give or take.
Okay. You spoke to the sponsor of the state plan. This is Sandy Republican Representative Robert Spendlove. He actually thinks that this delay from the Trump administration bodes well for the waiver request. Why does he think that?
Well, he sees this as the Trump administration being very thorough in their review. The reporting from the New York Times suggests that the president and his White House staff are in favor of these partial expansions, but that they're worried about some of the political fight around it. The question essentially comes down to whether you want to expand Medicaid at all,
right,
or if you want to stop those expansions so that Obamacare withers and dies.
Right, sort of undoing all of the Medicaid expansions that other states have done and getting rid of even partial expansion would be the ideal from the Trump administration's
way. Right, or even setting up a policy where those states that did fully expand could go backwards to a partial expansion.
Okay. I'm just going to remind listeners that they can call and join this conversation, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. How are you going to vote on the November initiative, and what do you think of the state's Medicaid expansion plan? Again, that's 801-355-8255. On the other side of this, the ballot initiative would then happen before we get that answer from the feds on a waiver. Does that have any impact on the initiative or on the chances for the initiative to pass, Ben? Is that, that's a tough question to answer, I think.
That's the question that I posed to essentially everyone involved, and they all said, who knows? So I think there is some expectation from lawmakers that by doing a partial expansion, it would take some of the oxygen away from the initiative. That's won't be the case now, because we're looking at current Medicaid versus a full expansion instead of this partial to a full. So, I mean, it's really anybody's guess. The initiative, they feel like they have the public support behind them. Representative Spendlove, he feels like they've crafted a common sense compromise, and so it'll be up to voters ultimately to choose which one they want.
I mean, if the state plan was put into effect, you're right, then you would have something to weigh the full expansion plan against. But I, you know, I don't know. Maybe this is a question for Robert Gierke. If you're a voter and you don't know if the state plan is a sure thing, does that make you more or less likely to sign on to the full expansion? I mean,
I think the legislators who are opposed to the full expansion were probably hoping that, you know, that this would be approved before voters go to the polls, and then they can say, look, we've already done something. We've expanded it somewhat. And so you don't need to vote for this. You know, it's going to be costly. It's not going to cover all that many more people. I mean, as Ben mentioned, it'd be about twice as many people. But, you know, we're covering the, you know, they can say we've covered the poorest of the poor, and everybody else can get subsidies on the exchange. So, you know, we've done our share. I think without that in place now, it makes it a lot harder for them to make that argument. I think voters are more likely, given the uncertainty of whether or not it would be approved by the Obama administration, are more likely to vote for it. I mean, I think it's helpful for the advocates and supporters of the initiative to be able to say, look, we've been waiting for years for this. We've foregone, you know, billions of dollars in funding for this program, left 160,000 people a year uncovered. And so let's go ahead and do this. You know, let's take it into our own hands. So I think it's a boost for the initiative.
Ben, the governor's spokesman, Paul Edwards, hinted at the potential or that there were potential political reasons that this waiver request might be being held up. Can you explain that? He sort of suggested that there was political calculus going on behind the scenes and that was the problem.
Right. I mean, I don't want to put any words in his mouth. I mean, anyone who's been watching this issue, it's pretty easy to read between the lines and see that the Trump administration is looking to weaken Obamacare. And if that is the reason that they're delaying these waivers, then that would be a political reason. That wouldn't be based on the substance of the waivers themselves. That would be political. So I think the governor's spokesman was alluding to some of that, that there is this political debate around Obamacare. And to the extent that's infecting these waiver applications, that's unfortunate.
Okay.
Well, you could also raise a scenario where if the federal government were to approve Utah's waiver, you could have other states that have already expanded going back and asking for a full match, which is what Utah wants, to cover fewer people. And the deal was always, we'll give you the full match if you cover up to this 132% of poverty. So it would be sort of unprecedented for Utah to be getting the full match, covering fewer people and imposing the work requirements, and it probably costing more money instead of less, nationally at least, not necessarily at the state level. And you've got this, you know, we've seen Arkansas had a similar request to Utah's, and I believe that one was rejected, or at least maybe it was on hold as well, Ben.
Sorry, I didn't mean to set you up. The only reason I'm confused is because there was one plan that was only approved in part and then another plan that was struck down in court, and I keep confusing the two.
I'm just going back to the question or the idea that this is political calculus on the part of the Trump administration, you know, disfavoring an Obama-era policy, Obamacare as it is. Wasn't the governor's decision, and maybe this is a question for Robert Gierke as opposed to a reporter, not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, wasn't that a political decision as well, or was it not? I mean—
Well, yeah. I mean, the governor had been pushing for several years to try to get his Healthy Utah proposal through, and Healthy Utah would actually cover more people than this the request for the waiver that, you know, the legislature approved. He just couldn't get the political support, particularly among House Republicans, to do that expansion. They were afraid it would be too expensive. It would put the state on the hook for unknown, you know, number of years for unknown, you know, for an expanding population. It was just going to be too costly and too much uncertainty from their standpoint.
Right.
You know, the governor has been pushing for this for quite some time. And so, you know, that was, he just didn't have the political backing from the legislature to do it.
To do the Healthy Utah plan.
To do the Healthy Utah plan, or to do, you know, and there have been proposals from the Democrats in particular to do a full expansion, and it's never gotten any traction.
But originally it was up to the governor to accept or not accept full Medicaid expansion.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the way Obamacare was crafted, the federal government left it up to the governor, but the state government, the state legislature, passed a bill that said the governor cannot agree to expand Medicaid without approval from the legislature. And the reasoning for that was the legislature is the one that has to authorize the funding for the Medicaid plan. If the state were to expand, and so they kind of tied its hands in that regard.
Okay, polling has been showing that there's more than 50% support for this expansion for the initiative that would fully expand Medicaid, and it just needs a simple majority to become law, I think, here in Utah. But Ben, the legislature could try to change the initiative after it's been passed by the voters. Correct? That's thanks to a new law.
Well, I mean, quite simply. Initiative, once approved, is a law like any other law, and the lawmakers can do whatever they want to the state's
right.
laws. They can repeal it, change it, amend it.
Good point.
They can do whatever they want. And when I spoke with Robert Spendlove, one interesting comment was, you know, I asked him about the timeline now, the chronology, where, you know, voters approve full, and then the federal government says, okay, we approve your partial. Which one is the real one? And Representative Spendlove said, we don't know. That's a question. Which anytime a lawmaker says there's a question between the public will and what we, the legislature, did, you can tell they're gearing up for a fight either way.
Right.
So this is – we're going to be seeing some talk about this next session no matter what.
No matter what. Matt Kahn, I'm senior managing editor. I'll bring you on this conversation just before we head to a break. And would that – would the legislature contradict the direct will of the voters on full Medicaid expansion? Is that – I mean, that's an opinion question, I guess, but do you think that they would?
We've seen in the past that when there has been a vote of the people, the legislature tends to stick with that. That doesn't mean they don't debate it. I mean, the one big example is school vouchers. The legislature passed school vouchers. It was repealed by voters, and we haven't seen that come back since. Mm. So it's hard when you're a lawmaker. As an individual lawmaker, you might say, I think the people got it wrong. But as the body, you would think that they would take the vote seriously.
I'd just suggest the one caveat to that, though, might be that if this narrowly passes, if we were talking about just right. a 51%, then you don't have a clear mandate from the people, and the legislature can say, well, you know, the public didn't really speak clearly on what they want on this. So that gives them a little bit more latitude, I think, to do that. The other thing I'd say is that, you know, these initiatives, the polling can be a little deceiving, particularly in the initiative process, because typically when people, we've seen it before, just not just in Utah, but in other states, when an initiative can be well ahead, 2/3% or 60%, and then when people get into the polling places, they tend to, you know, chicken out and vote against it. And particularly, we haven't seen the opposition, you know, to come out against this yet. And I think there will be. I think there's going to be a lot of concerns raised about the potential cost for a full Medicaid expansion.
Okay. Well, time will tell both for this, for the waiver that we're waiting for from the federal government and on this initiative process. And Ben, thanks very much for your reporting on this. I'm going to plug the KCPW program In the Hive, which this week tackled Medicaid expansion in Utah. Check it out at kcpw.org. You are tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We need to head to our first break of the show. When we return, we'll have more from this past week's news. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Kahn, reporter Benjamin Wood, and columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call us to join this conversation at 801-355-8255 or post your comments and questions at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Matt Kahn, I want to turn to a story out of Washington. There has been a ban on publishing online the schematics or the blueprints for making 3D printed guns. That ban is ending under the Trump administration, and in fact, the deadline, I think, was this week. So that ban has effectively ended, and we'll get to that. But there was a measure in the U.S. Senate that aimed to prevent anyone from publishing 3D printed gun blueprints. But that measure was thwarted by Utah Senator Mike Lee. Tell us how this played out, Matt.
So Senator Bill Nelson is a Democrat from Florida, and he attempted to pass a bill under what's called unanimous consent, which means As long as no senator stands up and objects, it's done. This is a fast-track measure in the Senate. And then what it would do is, as you said, it would ban anyone from posting any online plans to use any sort of 3D plastic printer to build a gun. Mike Lee was the one who stood up and objected. And we hadn't heard Mike Lee weigh in on this issue before this, but what he said was that it violates our First Amendment rights and essentially made the argument that in this country you're not allowed to have a bomb, but that doesn't mean you can't go online and find the rules on or the instructions on how to make one. The actual information is available. The restriction comes in the owning of it. And so conservatives, including Mike Lee, point to laws that say you cannot in this country own an untraceable firearm. And they're arguing that a gun made out of plastic that wouldn't be picked up in a metal detector would be therefore fall under that untraceable law. So he's saying what Bill Nelson was trying to do was restrict speech, not restrict the access to an object.
Okay, so First Amendment, not a Second Amendment argument, and akin to banning books. This is interesting because there's like the Anarchist Cookbook, which is a bomb making manual that is still being sold and that's in our libraries. Maybe I'll come back to this to you in a second, Matt, but I'll turn to Robert Gerke, who's a columnist here, and just ask, how does this look to you from where you sit as a columnist? The idea of the argument being made that it's a First Amendment issue and that the real crime is in the actual production of the untraceable gun.
Yeah, I mean, my initial reaction when I first saw this was, you know, Mike Lee's losing it. You know, it sounded like a no-brainer that we want to keep, you know, people from manufacturing their own guns in these 3D printers, and you know, if they're not detectable, there's some argument about whether or not they're detectable by airline security, but if it's potentially not detectable, then we want to be, you know, definitely want to keep them out of the hands of people who might want to take them on a plane. But when I started thinking about this more, I kind of came around to Mike Lee's point of view, because as you mentioned, the bomb making directions are not illegal. It's the making of the bomb or detonation of the bomb that's illegal, right? So, you know, if we're gonna start prohibiting things that, you know, the instructions, prohibiting publishing of instructions, then that's a pretty big step to take. And there is First Amendment protection, and there's precedent on this in the Supreme Court in the 1969 case of Brandenburg versus Ohio. They said unless there's an incitement to act on you know, a bomb building or something like, you know, along those lines, right, then it's a protected speech, and you can't just ban a book because it has those instructions. There are exceptions, obviously, for nuclear weapon.
Sure.
You know, you can't put blueprints for a nuclear weapon online. The Atomic Energy Act covers some of that. But, you know, I think there's room to protect the First Amendment and protect safety on this if you say, okay, well, possessing a 3D printed gun is against the law, or trying to get it into a secure facility is against the law. But just publishing or having access to the information itself shouldn't be.
Yeah, Lee, if I recall, Matt said that you know, essentially having this gun is already a crime. I mean, this is what Gerke's pointing out, is that having a so-called ghost gun would be the crime, and so that you know, you can have the plans for it, you can publish the plans, but if you make the gun, then you are breaking the law.
I don't know if that's as clear cut. That is an argument certain Republicans are making. But you know how we can create a law and then something new happens and it has to be tested to see if that actually falls under that law. We don't know for sure, but that is what Republicans like Mike Lee are saying. Now, Nelson, the Democratic senator, pushed back on Lee's argument, saying that we have lots of limits to our First Amendment rights. And one of the most famous is not screaming fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah.
He said, and this is a quote, "Why in the world would you assert First Amendment rights to publish instructions to make a plastic gun that someone could take through a metal detector into a crowded theater and start shooting in that theater instead of shouting fire?" Now, in that comment, he kind of bridges the gap between publishing a rule and owning the gun. But he didn't appreciate Lee objecting, though it's clear at this point in a Republican-controlled Senate, this would be a hard bill to get passed.
I guess, I mean, part of the point is that whether or not the gun is legal, if someone has the intent to do what Matt just described, I mean, they're going to find a way to do it. They'll be breaking the law either way, obviously.
Right. And I think the only inconsistency with the shouting fire in a crowded theater is there's an immediate risk. There's an immediate harm that comes from shouting fire in a crowded theater. And that's why the Supreme Court has put, they call them time, place, and manner restrictions on speech. This doesn't seem to have the direct imminent risk or the imminent peril of publishing. You know, you publish it, then you've got to go get the materials, you've got to build it, and then you've got to create an act, and there's several steps along that process. So, you know, there's obviously if the concern is that we don't want people making these guns, we don't want people possessing these guns or taking them, if we need to, you know, close loopholes in the law in that respect, then yeah, that's fine. But to prohibit publishing anything, I think, again, that's sort of ring some alarm bells in regards to the First Amendment.
Well, it's a nuanced story, and it's an interesting one to keep following. Arguments over keeping or not keeping a ban on publishing these instructions are actually going to be heard a week from today, and we'll see what happens there. There's a judge who's issued an order saying we can't publish these yet. There's a hold on publishing them online. So we'll keep following it. Matt Canham, Tribune Senior Managing Editor, I want to stick with you and turn to some public lands news from this past week. And reporter Brian Maffley has been following changes in process in how lands are leased for oil and gas development on Bureau of Land Management lands. Among the changes under Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is a much shorter public comment period on proposed leases. There are other changes, and I guess we'll get to some of those. But the big news this week, Brian reported that the BLM would be issuing leases on more than 500,000 acres in Utah, which is a pretty big number. Why is this upscaling of oil and gas leasing happening, Matt?
The easy answer is that we had a change in administration from a Democratic administration to a Republican one. And one of the big partisan differences in our country is how we look at oil and gas leasing. Republicans believe that we should use the resources we have in this country. In the Democratic side, there's strong environmental camps who say that we should be real careful about how we do that. We should protect the land. And where the Trump administration has come down is that the Obama era rules created long delays from the purchase of a lease, in which Brian's talking about, to the ability to actually drill. And so they want to streamline it. And one of the first steps is they want to streamline getting more leases out there. So as you said, they streamlined or they cut down the comment period from 30 days to 15 and in some cases 0 days. And they increase the amount of leasing they're going to do. So they do this quarterly. We'll have the next one in September and then one in December. But these are big chunks, more than 200,000 acres in September and more than 300,000 in December. And there's obviously dispute over the specific areas. The one in December includes some land in the Book Cliffs area that has long been disputed whether there should be oil and gas drilling there. Now, there's also the debate over whether oil and gas companies need these leases at all. As Brian points out, in the state of Utah alone, companies own leases on 1 million acres that are not being used. Hmm. Now, the companies would argue that once you own a lease, it's not easy just to go get the machinery and start drilling. You got to go through the environmental review process. And depending on the individual parcel of land, that can stretch out for years. So the idea of having a variety of types of land that you buy it during these lease auctions and can go online at different periods of time is good for the company.
And is the stretching out of that, I mean, okay, so maybe it stretches out for years because of NEPA, the environmental review process. But the adding new leases to the mix, I mean, is that sort of speculative investment for the growth of a company or something? I mean, what?
Yes, okay. Exactly. I mean, I think there are times in this, you know, the oil and gas economy that are boom and bust. And so as a company, you want as much flexibility as you can possibly get. So the more leases you control, the more flexibility you have, depending on where you are as a company. And I think that's really the argument from that standpoint. If you're a big company, you want to gobble up as many leases as possible, whether you sit on them or you drill them immediately.
The article in the Tribune points out that this is a larger area or larger amount of leases of land, that is, than the lease from when activist Tim DeChristopher kind of monkey wrenched a protest bid against those leases. This is kind of an act of civil disobedience that some listeners who maybe have moved to the area recently or are younger might not remember. And Matt, can you remind us kind of what happened there?
Yeah, he was an environmental activist who went in and to one of these auctions in person and made bids with no intention of actually paying for them, just to thwart the actual auction itself. And he was arrested for that. He was imprisoned for that. And for a time that was lengthier than some anticipated, and he became a symbol for, as you said, civil disobedience in this area. Since that happened, there's changes in how these auctions take place. They're online, so it's a lot harder to go and
show up in person
and thwart the actions of these kind of things. So it's time has changed these things.
Robert Gerke, do you want to comment on this new, well, sort of it's behind the banner of American energy dominance, the Trump administration streamlining processes for leasing lands in Utah?
Well, it's hard to see how in a 15-day comment period over the broad number of leases that they're talking about now that there's any realistic opportunity for public input or to even vet the areas that are being put out there. So it's kind of I think Matt's right that they're coming at it from, as you said, energy dominance, that they're trying to flood the market with these leases. But right now it's also a question of whether the industry actually wants these leases. The market's pretty soft right now for oil and gas, and it seems like they can buy them and sit on them. I guess you get them cheap now and drill them later, maybe. But, flooding the market with additional oil and gas leases doesn't seem like it's going to help the market, frankly. But, from the environmental standpoint, environmental groups are obviously upset because, that it just means there's that much more on the table, much less time for them to respond to it and to vet the process. And so they're taking these shortcuts. There's going to be stuff that gets missed.
Sure. Matt Canham, environmentalists and hunter organizations and anglers, they've expressed concern about the size of these leases and, I guess, specific areas for leases under consideration that were announced by the Interior Department.
Yeah, I mean, to just piggyback on what Robert said, part of these groups that you mentioned, their complaint is that it takes an established group that has been looking at these for a number of years to make a realistic comment in such a short comment period. Let's say you lived in one of these areas and you want to weigh in. 15 days to put something together that's meaningful and thoughtful is hard for an average Utahan who might want to participate. But yes, there are some of these areas that are more sensitive than others. I mentioned the Book Cliffs is one that has long been looked at as an area that is something that's sensitive. But there's also, as you said, there's places where anglers would like to go, like the headwaters of the Price River. Mm. And there are tributaries there that are good trout fishing. And they're worried that oil and gas drilling in that area could ruin that experience for them. And so there's different areas where they're trying to comment on. We'll see if there are any pullbacks. There might be one or two on the fringes here, but it's clear that the Trump administration plans to move forward with a big, broad leasing auctions throughout the rest of this year.
And just to kind of take it from another angle, too, it's not just the people it's not just environmental groups who might be concerned about these, who are given very little time. It's also the BLM that has to do the cultural inventories and the environmental inventories that sort of to make sure that these are leases that they won't are not going to be damaging or detrimental to the landscape or to the cultural artifacts. And so to put them on a tighter time frame too is also going to mistakes will be made.
Hmm. I mentioned the shortened public comment period. It's short enough that I think for one of the auctions, you mentioned a December and September auction, the public comment period is already closed, and so that's
for September. It's over, yeah. And for December, there's only a few more days.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on the story and see what happens from here. We're going to take another quick break on the show, and then when we return, we will turn to the Inland Port Authority Board having its very first meeting. It is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Ben Wood, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments. Ben, this week the 11-member Inland Port Board held its first official meeting, if I understand that correctly.
This is successfully official meeting.
Yeah, right. They tried once before. It was a false start. This is the board that's going to manage the development of this massive project on Salt Lake City's west side. You covered this meeting. Maybe you can tell us what happened there to start. How did it? Who did they elect as officers, mm-hmm. and what happened?
Yeah, I mean the purpose of the meeting was to impanel the board itself, to swear in members and to vote on leadership, which they did. So they elected Derek Miller as chair. He's the president of the Salt Lake Chamber, and the vice chair of the Port Authority is James Rogers, who is a Salt Lake City councilman who also lives and represents the west side of Salt Lake City. After that, they had some shopkeeping business with, you know, setting schedules and committees and calendars. It was a very procedural starting point meeting.
Sure. So you mentioned Derek Miller and James Rogers. Were those appointments sort of, or those elections, I guess, sort of what we were expecting for chair and vice chair of this board?
Yeah, it wasn't a big surprise. The vote was unanimous. You know, Derek Miller, obviously, in the Salt Lake Chamber, he's very involved in the business community. With all the talk about the city's role in this, electing James Rogers vice chair seemed like a salve to some of those concerns. I don't think there's a lot of surprise there. It kind of represents a good faith effort to heal some of those divisions and move forward.
Let's back up a little bit and just get a definition of what this thing is. Inland port, we talk about it a lot, and defining it can be difficult. I mean, it's meant to be a place where goods that are being offloaded from foreign countries are processed. Is that correct?
Right. So we might expect goods that are being imported or exported to come in through our seaborne ports, New York, California, et cetera. There's a lot of traffic there. They're a little congested. So the idea being skip those, fly into Utah, do all the necessary paperwork there, and then stick it on planes, trains, and automobiles to go wherever you need it to go. So bypass the coast, come to the desert, and we'll take care of you here.
If you look in a dictionary, though, I mean, Merriam-Webster, if you say port, are they going to tell you that it's, you know, on water? It usually would be, right?
Well, I mean, if we're getting pedantic, it means doorway. Okay. So it could be anywhere.
All right. Fantastic. Ben, there were a couple of commitments that were made by the board during this first sort of perfunctory meeting. The chairman, again, this is Derek Miller, who's president of the Salt Lake Chamber. He made a motion that the board be subject to Utah's Open and Public Meetings Act and to other transparency laws. Why was he doing that?
I spoke to Derek Miller after the meeting. He talked about how he wants this to be as open and transparent as possible. He wants the public to be aware of the agendas, the minutes. You know, that he would like this to be a open and collaborative process to the best of the board's ability.
And that's happening because, well, actually, first off, wouldn't this board be subject to Utah's open and the open and public meetings act anyway?
Yeah, as a subdivision of the state, they're already obligated to comply with the Robert Open and Public Meetings Act. And since they're funded entirely by taxpayer money, then they would obviously be subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act anyway. But I think this is sort of a putting a good face on it. Hey, look how transparent we are, especially when we have to be.
Part of that stems from the fact that this process up until now has faced criticism for not being necessarily transparent or being sort of methodical.
Yeah.
I mean, really, every step of this process has been mired by controversy around transparency. The original bill was slapped together in the last minutes of the legislature to the point that many lawmakers afterwards remarked about not fully understanding what it did. The city immediately complained about being left out of all of their input being disregarded in favor of this bill that was cobbled together. After that, there was a special session called to amend it where it was heard in a committee last on the agenda. The public was given 1 minute to respond. It was kind of rushed through. They voted on it. It's done. And then, of course, we had members of the board who had to be removed after appointing themselves because they violated some of the rules about membership on the board. I mean, there's just been a raft of issues with the creation of this inland port.
And that's a great summary right there. Outgoing House Speaker Greg Hughes, of course, first appointed himself and then was removed from the board. Well, actually resigned from the board because of the conflict of interest provisions within the bill. I'm going to go back to this meeting for a second here, Ben, and just talk more about this because there was in addition to that open transparency sort of initiative from Miller, there was also a request that a certain number of board meetings be held on the west side, and this was coming from the vice chair, James Rogers.
Right. I mean, his suggestion was, this inland port is located in the northwest quadrant. There's a lot of concern among west side residents about this, so let's have the meetings where they could go to them. Let's have them on the west side in the evenings. Let's try to make this as easy as possible for west side residents to be present for.
An interesting comment in this first meeting from House Majority Whip Francis Gibson, who is on this board because he was appointed again by outgoing House Speaker Greg Hughes, we should say, who, as we said, had to resign from the board. Gibson's comment was about the environmental concerns being expressed by groups that were in attendance at this meeting. Can you tell us about that part of this?
Yeah, and just to kind of set it up, Derek Miller, he opened the meeting to public comment, which nobody was necessarily expecting. It wasn't on the agenda. I mean, again, this was a very procedural meeting. So a few different groups who were present got up to the microphone, and in essence, they all said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so from such-and-such. It's great to be here. Thanks for being public. We look forward to working with you guys in the future." And after a few of these groups, many of which had an environmental bent to them, had spoken, Representative Gibson kind of looked down at the person who was at the mic at the time and said, "Before the next meeting, can you all get together and figure out who's going to talk to us so that we don't have to hear all of you every time?" And a bit of a tonal shift in the room. a woman who hadn't planned on speaking got up the microphone and pushed back a little bit, saying, "Sorry, we're individual groups with individual viewpoints, and we expect you to listen to us, or at least pretend to." So I don't know exactly where that leaves things, but it was a bit of a shift from the earlier side of the meeting that was big on transparency and collaboration.
Robert Gerke, one big question that these environmental groups have is how this is going to impact air quality. There are also questions about impacts to the Great Salt Lake, which is already in kind of a crisis state. What's your take on this request from Francis Gibson?
Well, I mean, the optics are pretty abysmal, right? I mean, if you're going to, as Ben mentioned, everything leading up to that point was about transparency, and now Francis is saying we don't really want to hear from you. It kind of lends to this whole notion that the public has been shut out of this process, and they don't want to be bothered with these dissenting voices when they've got a mission that they think they're on to try to build this port. The problem with limiting the input on things like this is, as you mentioned, air quality is an issue. You've got the wetlands, which is an issue. You've got there are different environmental concerns from different groups, and to say, okay, well, everybody has to speak with one voice just doesn't work. You're not going to have all of the different companies that want to ship stuff all speak with one voice. I mean, you're going to have to. It's I guess one of the cumbersome parts of a public process is that you actually have to pretend to pay attention to the public, and really the public has been pretty much shut out of this from day one, right? So, this is now that this board has been stood up is going to be their opportunity to provide some input or provide some guidance to the board. And they should listen to those voices, as many voices as want to lend themselves to the discussion.
Well, it sounds a little bit like he's looking at, as Robert points out, that, he wouldn't probably have said this to have all the businesses come together and say, "All right, we need one voice." But he's looking at environmental issues as a kind of special interest. I guess the counter to that would be that the air you breathe is not.
I mean, they're not gonna have Amazon and you know a coal company or a oil company or you know any of these other shipping companies that are going to be moving products through there. They're not going to have them all kind of come together and speak with one voice because they have different concerns and they do business differently and they do you know they have different aims and so to say you know okay well. Ducks Unlimited and Trout Unlimited and Healthy, you know, Sierra Club and Heal Utah, all of these groups have to, you know, figure out one voice to speak with. It's not the way the public process works, period. And so I think maybe Representative Gibson may walk that back a little bit. And you know, when you have this board and the whole point of the board is to, you know, to make these decisions in a collaborative and public way, supposedly, then to clamp down on public input is a little bit short-sighted.
I want to remind listeners to call us with your questions and comments, 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Matt Canham, your take on the very first Inland Port Board meeting. I mean, these guys are talking about Representative Francis Gibson's request for the environmental groups to sort of consolidate into one voice. There's also, assignment of officers. How do you see this?
I think the people who are trying to push this inland port feel a little impatient. They look at this as a great economic driver for the state, and they want to move forward, and they want to move forward fast. And they look at potential critics are as people who might slow down that process. As we talked about what an inland port is and how it functions, this is a new thing for the state. And there's a lot of questions. And I know the city has a lot of questions because it's been sold as something where foreign goods come here and we disperse them through the United States, which would happen. But we also know from talking to people that this is a way to get Utah coal overseas too. Mm. And that is a big driver for certain people in our state. There's been a fight in Oakland, the state helped fund a coal port there that we would ship our coal through that process, and that still might happen. But there's a lot of debate over, well, okay, if you move coal by train and you don't cover it and it goes through a residential area and there's coal dust blowing off, how does that affect people's health?
And this is why the city of Oakland initially tried to ban the through transfer of coal in their community.
And you could see that maybe people on the west side would have similar concerns if train lines are going through this inland port as expected, is moving Utah coal to a place where it could be shipped overseas. And I think that I get the economic interest in trying to move fast, but in a project this massive and this complicated, we're bound to hit controversy after controversy as this goes forward.
There has been, you pointed out that there were negotiated changes to this project. City council members met with lawmakers to cut a deal, and then there was the special session to enact those changes. Looming in the background was this threat of litigation from maybe the city or from an environmental group or another organization. Is that still a possibility?
Yes.
Okay, an easy answer. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no one to this point has said, here is my lawsuit that I have filed today. But, I mean, just from what we're hearing from Mayor Biskupski and various groups, certainly the option's on the table, and it seems all but inevitable that someone at some point will be challenging this in court.
Yeah, former Mayor Ted Wilson wrote a guest column in the Tribune last week, it may have been last weekend, where he talked about the Ripper Clause, which settle in. We're going to talk about the Ripper Clause.
Tell us about that, Robert Gerke.
But basically, it's a portion of the state constitution that says that the legislature can't basically create a city to do municipal duties within a city. And that's essentially what, from the mayor's point of view, when the legislature has handed over land use planning authority, taxing authority, things like that, then they're basically behaving like a city. And as former Mayor Wilson suggested, that could be a violation of the Ripper Clause. If the city or if another party decides that they want to pursue that would be the course of the litigation. The mayor has certainly made the threat in the past that the city would litigate it. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, but the council tried to put some constraints on that by saying the council won't fund any lawsuit filed by the city. So that complicates things a little bit.
Whether or not they can do that is a question.
Whether or not they can do that.
And the mayor has now raised the question of whether or not that is binding as well. I mean, there's clauses all over that you can interpret.
Right? So yeah, but I think there's bound to be litigation
could
on this,
it, could it
whether
derail,
it comes from the city, whether it comes from the. I mean, I think it's inevitable that there will be environmental groups that will file against, over out of concerns for wetlands and air quality. So I think the lawyering up is probably just beginning.
The interesting part is you can stop the structure of an inland port, but not necessarily the beginnings of it. I mean, even this week, we had Amazon hiring 1,500 people for their what they call a fulfillment center, essentially a warehouse where they package and ship goods that is in this area that would be the inland port. Well, we still have trucks going in and out of that area. We have airplanes going in and out of the area. So it's, as this state structure gets built to coordinate this, companies are already moving forward.
Yeah, and this is something the city had been working on this for couple years before we even got to the point of the legislature stepping into it. Back in December, the city signed an agreement with several of the potential development partners, sort of laying out some framework for how this is going to proceed. The question now is how much of that survives now that the Inland Port Authority is going to be stepping in and taking over. But, Rio Tinto owns a good chunk of the land out there. The LDS Church owns some of the land out there. There's a number of landowners who are already kind of proceeding along this course to start the framework. Whether litigation tries to stop parts of it, there are parts of it that are going to, as Matt said, kind of go on their own momentum at this point.
Intractable. I mean, essentially, litigation might stop some portion of it, but development will continue.
It might stop a coordinated rail hub where goods can be moved efficiently, but semi-trucks can go out to FedEx's, big building out there anytime they want.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned, Matt, the air quality concerns from, coal shipments of uncovered coal. And one of the solutions that House Speaker Greg Hughes presented was, putting lids on the coal trucks going by. But just from an air quality standpoint, the increase in traffic has got to be a concern as well. The amount of semis you just described on our west side going out to do that is going to add to our air quality woes.
Exactly. And I think that's part of these conversations is how are these goods moved? There's a debate over how much of it will be by rail and how much by truck. And that depends on the good, right, and where it's going. So, how this actually plays out, what this board does, these decisions this board makes, for some people it might feel like this is a business park that I don't need to worry about. But the ramifications on Salt Lake City and the state is going to be huge,
both economically and in other ways.
Yeah.
I want actually just for a second go back to Ben Wood and ask a final question on this, which is if, we talked about the city conceivably litigating against this, trying to stop it. Is there a chance that the city might get more involved from the administration level? We know that the council has been engaged in this process, but now that there is say a commitment to transparency and what the board announced this week, will that lure the city back in? I don't know if that's a question for you or Robert Gerke.
To this point, the city council has been taking the strategy of playing friendly and trying to get along to get good treatment. The mayor, of course, is being more antagonistic. So, I mean, it's almost as if we have this good cop, bad cop, only they're not partners. They're just kind of doing their own thing. So, I mean, I would expect that for the time being, the city council will continue to, try to make inroads by playing along. And, of course, James Rogers being the vice chair, that puts them in a position to, call some shots. The mayor will be antagonizing. If that, at some point those dynamics could change, there's really no way to say.
Finally, and maybe Matt or Robert can weigh in on this, but does it matter, is it beneficial to the city that you have, a city council member who's the vice chair and then somebody from the Salt Lake City Chamber as the chairman of this board in terms of how they're thinking about the impacts on the city from this?
Probably yes, and I think again the optics of it are probably helpful. That's the representation at the top of the board. I don't know that obviously James Rogers representing that a good portion of the area that will be the that is now I guess the Inland Port boundary. You know, you can say that, well, now he's responsive to his constituents in the area, which I think is something that is needed. I don't think they've really listened to the constituents in the west side of Salt Lake very much at all. These community council meetings kind of got brushed aside by the legislature, and the representatives, the legislative representatives, weren't consulted at all on any of the, any portion of this. So, you know, you need to have some at least sign or symbol of representation. As far as Derek Miller in the chamber, probably less impactful in the sense that he represents, you know, business interest more than you know, the citizens of that portion of the city. But you know, it is I guess a positive signal to the, you know, as opposed to putting, like, say, Representative Gibson in charge of it. He's from Mapleton. He's not from the area, and so, you know, it's a good cosmetic fix.
Okay. Guys, I'm sorry that I'm going to cut us off here and have us go directly to our underplayed stories of the week, because we have run long in this conversation about the inland port. Who's ready with a quick underplayed story? Matt Canham?
Sure. The Utah Education Association is the state's largest teacher union, and famously there's the UEA weekend in schools where everyone gets 2 days off. For the first time in 100 years, the teachers are not getting together at the conference. And that meant people were worried they were going to cancel the two-day break. They weren't really worried about the conference. They're worried about the break. So far, the break is going to survive. UEA weekend is October 18th and 19th.
All right, some days off. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
This interesting story out of Riverton. There was a lawsuit filed this past week by a man who said that he was getting getting food at McDonald's with his family. And he started getting tingling sensations and getting woozy. And come to find out, there was a sort of a synthetic heroin substitute that had been put into his Diet Coke, he said. He's filed a lawsuit against McDonald's because he said McDonald's knew that one of their employees had a drug problem and didn't do anything about it. One of the more interesting pieces of this is that they asked for video of the, you know, they have video, obviously, right, all the time. But McDonald's had destroyed the video, so they don't have video of the day in question. So
interesting,
you know. So he's sued. Yeah, one more quick one. I don't know if you saw Donovan Mitchell paid for an iPhone repair man in Salt Lake City who said he couldn't pay for it. Donovan Mitchell, you gotta love the guy, right?
Ben, can you do? Yeah, you got it. Ben, can you do a 10-second underplayed story?
Yes. There was a viral story about a Mormon mother who was punished by her local leadership for breastfeeding in church. Our colleagues Peggy Fudgerstack and Dave Noyce interviewed the mother on the Tribune's podcast Mormon Land. So you can hear her story from herself.
All right. Ben Wood, Robert Gerke, Matt Canham, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and also to our producer, Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week.